Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thank you so much for listening or downloading. I am your trusty host, Neil Horwitz. You can hit me up on LinkedIn, where I'll post more content, and also follow me on Twitter at NJH287, and of course, get the podcast and other content at DSMSports.net and other podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, all that good stuff. Really psyched for today's show. Someone I've admired for a while who does great work and has really evolved with the space and managed to survive all these years. He's been doing this for over 20 years. Talk today with Ryan McGee. He is a senior writer for ESPN, ESPN the Magazine, ESPN.com. Does a lot of content for the Four Letter Network. And we're going to pick his brain today about all the things that he does at ESPN and really throughout his career working in the redneck beat, as he put it. But before we get to our conversation with Ryan, this episode's helpful tool. This helpful tool is all about captions. These days, I'm sure we had a shareable stat in previous episodes about how many folks or how many users are watching video, consuming video without the sound on. You know, a lot of times you're in line at Subway, you're sitting in class, or you're sitting at work even, or you're stealing a minute here or there, and you don't have the sound turned on, you don't have earbuds in, wherever it may be, and so you're watching video without sound, and so captions are really a big thing these days. And there's a lot of ways to get captions on your videos. You know, YouTube and Facebook will accept uploaded files. You can also set some automated captioning, which is hit or miss in terms of how good it will work. But today's helpful tool helps you create those caption files, SRT files, whatever kind of file you're looking for. And it's called rev.com, R-E-V.com. Now, it's not free. I believe it's 99 cents for every minute. So it's not too bad, but also not overly cheap. So you have to be careful or ration out how often you'll use rev.com. But super simple tool. I've heard others using it. I've not actually used it myself yet. I'll be completely honest with you. But you get the SRT file. You get the file that's ready to upload to Facebook or to YouTube or wherever you're trying to do it. Obviously, those are the two most popular video platforms these days, Twitter as well. And voila, you have captions. They'll also do subtitles as well. If you can do captions on your own videos, you can get maybe a little more stylistic with it. But this is a great, helpful tool. If you're just looking to add captions to your Fire 2-3 minute video and you spend a couple bucks to do it, well, it's a great investment because so many of those users will get to your video without the sound on, and it makes it that much more powerful. And even with the sound on, to reinforce the messaging going through that video. So take a look. If you're looking for a quick way to caption your videos, check out rev.com and give it a go. All right, that's episode's helpful tool. We'll be right back to have a really good conversation with Ryan McGee of ESPN. All right, back from this episode's helpful tool, and I'm really psyched for today's guest, someone I've been following for a long time, one of the best writers that I know. He somehow finds great content to write about all the time. Joined on the podcast by Ryan McGee. He is a senior writer for ESPN, ESPN the Magazine, ESPN.com, and is all over ESPN. Welcome to the podcast today, Ryan.
Thank you. Yeah, the old title used to be senior writer, ESPN the Magazine, and then one day I think they realized that we all do a bunch of stuff for everything. So we all just became senior writers, ESPN. I guess it's better than junior writer.
There you go. And you got to be multi-channel these days anyway. If you were just a magazine writer, you wouldn't last too long, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's a fact. That is an absolute fact.
So really excited to have you on the show today, not just because I love to infuse some Southern charm to the show, but also because you've had a really impressive career and continue to do it these days. And so before we get into the meat of the discussion, though, want to hear about your background, your path to get to where you are today, and any tips for folks that want to do what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really fortunate. You know, I work with what I like to call a redneck beat, which is, I have a pretty deep motorsports background, mm-hmm. and then you throw college football on top of that, and then through the magazine, I've gotten to do a lot of different stories that I never thought I would ever be able to do, and E60 and all those things. So I'm very, very fortunate, but it's fun. I mean, you said it. I mean, I think the key is, one day you wake up, you realize you've been doing this for a long time, and I have, but the key is to be open-minded. If I've been one of these guys that just declared 20 years ago, well, I'm just a magazine writer, or I'm just a so-and-so. You know, those guys, it's hard to find them anymore. You got to diversify, or it's probably not going to be around.
And how did you come up in the game? I mean, did you start off, I know you had some production experience early on, and then and worked for NASCAR Media for a little bit. Tell me about how you worked your way up through those pathways.
Well, I tell people all the time, don't try to do it the way I did it, because the way I did it was kind of a different road that I took. But I started right out of college. I started at ESPN as a production assistant, which is the entry level job. Went to Bristol, Connecticut, answered the phones, ran prompter, did all the grunt work. And the big thing is you cut highlights, right? You watch a game and you figure out what was the best part, what the best parts of the game, and you write and produce a highlight for SportsCenter. And so I did that. I was in Bristol for a couple of years doing that. And it's like, I tell people, it's like going to Harvard, going to Yale. It's going to Stanford. Mm-hmm. You don't sleep and you work all the time and you don't make any money. And it's the greatest 2 years you'll ever have. there's not a day of my life that I don't lean back on something that I did or something someone said to me or a mistake that I made, because I made plenty of them. And then, ESPN was, this is 22 years ago, and ESPN was so much smaller then.
Mm-hmm.
There were only, I think, 4 Southerners in the entire company.
Wow.
And, it was me, Reese Davis, Stu Scott, who only claimed to actually be Southern by half the time. Sometimes he says from New York, sometimes from Greensboro. and then we had an editor, and that was really it. And so when my first week on the job at ESPN, Jeff Gordon had just won the inaugural Brickyard 400 at Indianapolis. And ESPN, as you know, had televised NASCAR since the network had started.
Yeah.
And NASCAR was becoming a really big deal inside the building, like with the SportsCenter people. And as the only production person with a Southern accent, and I was born in Rockingham, North Carolina, which would have been a legendary track there, they started coming to me. Well, hey, what does a round of wedge mean? And what does a yellow flag mean?
Yeah.
Where in the world is Pocono? And all these things. And I don't know that I actually knew as much as they thought that I did, but I knew way more than they did, And I realized real quick, I wanted to work college football, baseball, whatever else. So I realized real quick that the line of people waiting to work on, college football was around the building. The way line people waiting to work on NASCAR was me. And
yeah.
So, I got promoted. I got moved back to North Carolina, where I'm from. And we started a show called RPM Tonight, which is a nightly motorsports show. And then ESPN the magazine started in 1998. And one of their writers they'd hired from Sports Illustrated was looking for help on a story that he was supposed to do about Michael Andretti, the IndyCar driver.
Mm-hmm.
And I was helping him with it. And finally, he goes, "You just want to write it?" And I was like, "Yeah." And so I wrote 300 or 400 words on Michael Andretti, and that started my relationship with ESPN the magazine. And my favorite part as a producer, as a feature producer, was to write scripts, which I still do a lot around the company. And so becoming a writer was, it was a pretty natural transition, and I started doing both at the same time, and here we are.
And you did spend some time with NASCAR itself as well. What was that role like, and how did that, I guess, differ from your role with ESPN in terms of the goals of it, I guess, when you're working for a league that's trying to sell tickets and drive revenue and versus ESPN, which has a different set of objectives, perhaps?
Yeah, it was a pretty crazy transition, and the way that happened was that I was hired away from ESPN when the NASCAR TV contract changed hands at the start of 2001. Fox hired me away from ESPN to produce a nightly motorsports show to compete with my old show with RPM Tonight.
Interesting.
And then Fox, as part of their TV deal, went in with NASCAR to start a production company, 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on the show called Totally NASCAR with Steve Burns for a couple of years, and we had a great time. I always thought about it as like being, I had worked on the Death Star, and now I was working for the Rebel Alliance. Not good guys and bad guys, but just the difference between having all these resources at ESPN and working out of a double-wide trailer, working for Fox Sports Net. And so when I did that for a couple of years, we had some success, and Fox wanted me to move into this other company they co-owned with NASCAR. NASCAR, at the time, it was called NASCAR Images. It became NASCAR Media Group. I think it's NASCAR Productions now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's NFL Films for race cars. That's what it was. And it was interesting. I'm telling you, because the perspective is so different when you're working for the league or for the sanctioning body, in my case.
Mm-hmm.
everything you do has a marketing angle, or everything you do has a promotional angle.
Yeah.
And so me, as a journalist slash writer slash producer, we got to do this. And they're like, well, we can't do this because of so-and-so, or we can't do that because of so-and-so. And it was hard, but it helped me understand. So I was there for a few years, and when I went back to ESPN, it really helped me understand the perspective of why the sanctioning body does some of the things that it does, or why a race team does some of the things that they do, because, you know, I've been on the inside, so I kind of understood the business model. I didn't agree with a lot of it, but at least I understood what they were trying to do. And so that was, it ended up being, it wasn't the greatest job in the world by any stretch, but it certainly helped me gain some perspective. There's no way I would have ever had that otherwise.
What was that, the story that NASCAR was trying to tell when you were there? I mean, we look at, you know, the heyday, I guess, of looking at when Earnhardt and then Jeff Gordon after that, and it was it very much became a lot of superstars, individuals that fans could really get into. Maybe it sometimes at the expense of really focusing on the sport itself. Was it you guys just trying to get the best content that's going to get the most viewers, most people talking about it, or was it more this is the angle we want to go at this with? This is the story we want to be telling.
A little bit of both, and that was the struggle. That was the tug of war, you know, because, you know, there weren't a lot of, and I'm talking, so this is the years, I'm talking about 2004, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
So these were when a lot of the decisions were made that didn't go over really well with the core audience.
Right.
You know, stuff like,
Car Tomorrow.
Like it was, the Car Tomorrow, and there was a mandate, no country music, like, they told the racetracks, you're not going to book any country artists for the national anthem. They told us, we were going to HBO and, you know, all these networks trying to pitch TV shows. And they're saying, well, we want to do this. And then the NASCAR marketing people were like, well, we're not using any country music. And we really want you to focus on just the top five most popular drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really like, I was saying my job was to carry the bucket of water from one end of the hallway to the other, and neither end of the hallway actually wanted the bucket of water. So it was, but I learned a lot, you know, but I also was in meetings all the time, which is exactly what I never wanted to do. And so
right.
It was, but like I say, it was an education. And you know, I won college. I was just talking to the athletic director of one of these schools involved in the NCAA baseball tournament about this. There's a cautionary tale there for the NFL, for college sports, whatever, which is, you know, NASCAR was doing so well and making so much money, they made a lot of bad decisions, but it kind of didn't matter because the money just kept rolling in. Well, then after the economic crash in 2008, phone quit ringing. And you kind of had a generation of salespeople that didn't know how to sell. The sales guys were across the hallway from me at NASCAR Media Group, and those guys struggled because for years they just took orders. And then all of a sudden they had to go sell. And I tell college athletic directors this all the time, be careful. You know, don't just assume that there's always going to be 100,000 people coming to the game, because one day there might not be, and you might not know how to, you know, pound the pavement and sell tickets. So, I learned a lot. But I'm glad I'm not doing that anymore.
No, that's some really good insight there, and you can never get too fat and happy, even in the good times. And I guess speaking then of having to evolve and transition, kind of want to hear about when social media first came on the radar for you, you know, at ESPN or even at, you know, maybe probably at ESPN. I imagine by the time it really came into the fold, and how, you know, if it did hit you early on that this is something that I need to use, whether it's for journalistic needs or just to push my work out there, and establish relationship with the fans, and you know, how, or whether it came more from the ESPN side telling you. So give me an idea of what that introduction was like, and how you sought to navigate the waters early on.
Well, I mean, you know, like everyone else, I actually was on Facebook pretty early. And I know this because when I set up my account, I accidentally did something that sent an invitation to join Facebook, which was brand new at the time, to my entire address book. And I have a lot of athletes, you know, in my address book. And so I got guys like Al Unser Jr. and Carl Lewis going, what is this? You know, why? you know, why are you sending me this? And it was people I had interviewed for stories before.
Yeah.
But I was telling everybody, I got Carl Lewis on Facebook. I was telling everybody, thank me for that, I guess. But I, so you know this because this is how you and I have gotten to know each other is through Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on, I jumped on the Twitter. I remember when it happened. I did it. It was during the College World Series. It would have been 2008. And the reason is because I was writing a book. And mm-hmm. I thought this might be a way to promote my book. And it was an interesting experience right off the bat. And that's, you know, I'm kind of, as you know, I'm kind of a smart aleck, and I like to make dumb comments about stuff. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I was having this conversation with her. She's not on Twitter because 13-year-olds don't do Twitter. They do Instagram.
Right.
And she's on Instagram, and I was explaining to her, you know, it's called social media for a reason. You know, something that you might post on Facebook to your buddies when you've been overserved in QS, that's fine, but you don't want to put that on Twitter. You know, you don't want to put that out there. And so I'm glad that I didn't have hardly any followers when I first started that thing. So I'm pretty sure I probably, trying to be funny, said some things that I immediately probably wanted to take back. But I like it. I mean, listen, I have relationships with people through Twitter. I mean, like you, I have relationships with people from Twitter that I wouldn't have otherwise.
Right.
And I've gotten to know. I mean, I walked into a ballpark just today as part of the NCAA baseball tournament, and I know I've never met any of those people, but we all feel like we know each other because we're Twitter buddies, you know, or Instagram or whatever. So it's an interesting case. My buddy Chris Lowe that covers college football with me, CeeLo's great line is, if you say, CeeLo, what's Twitter good for? And he says, posting links to your stories and getting fired. and so I think the sweet spot is somewhere in the middle of that. Posting links to your work, and having a little bit of fun, but not having too much fun.
No, that's well put for sure. And I think, you know, if nothing else, Twitter is a way to find people with shared interests. You know, you find things that you're all interested in. And I'm interested to hear, you know, how that has really helped you and your work more than the average journalist, I guess, because as you kind of spoke to early on, you're kind of the redneck beat. You're on the sports that are really popular down south, and that's, you know, actually where some of the most avid sports fans in the country reside, whether it's college football, college baseball, motorsports. So was there something early on where you're like, wow, like this is a much more engaged, bigger community than I thought, or is the first time you're able to really see that? Because I'm sure you can see website traffic to your stories early on, or, you know, maybe the old school emails or even old school letters. But was it sort of like, hey, there's this whole community here that likes what I do, and now I can connect them on a whole new level? Was there that moment early on, or was just, you know, you always kind of knew that was there, and this Twitter gave it more of a platform?
No, it's just more instantaneous now. So, I mean, you mentioned it. I can remember back in the day, like I said, when I worked on RPM Tonight, and we were on every single night on ESPN2, and there's no internet. I mean, the internet is a baby. And so the only way we could get feedback about our show was we had a fax number that we would put up on the show. and we'd ask a poll question. And so this is on ESPN2, and you come in the next morning, and there'd be a big pile of papers on the floor.
Wow.
And it would be people responding to, or they'd have questions for Benny Parsons, or they'd have questions for, one of our IndyCar guys.
Yeah.
And so that's only it. And the other thing we had was there was a newspaper, a weekly newspaper called Winston Cup Scene, that became NASCAR Scene. I mean, listen, Bob Pockers, Todd Jensen, and Kenny Bruce, I mean, all these great, you know, NASCAR writers, Mike Embry, they all been in the NASCAR Hall of Fame at some point. They all wrote for this newspaper. And they published 5 pages of letters to the editor. And that was the only way we'd ever get any feedback on the show.
Yeah.
And it might just be one woman wrote a letter in, and I hate so-and-so. That's all we got. And so then it became email. And I used to do a chat room every Monday for ESPN.com, and I would, you know, I'd get feedback there. But now it's just instantaneous. But what you also learn, though, is you can't listen to all of it. And after 20 years, from faxes to emails to, you know, chat rooms to comment, you know, the comment section under stories to this, you kind of learn what to listen to or what not to. And the people that you shouldn't listen to, they should identify themselves pretty quick. You know,
yeah.
It's you have to be careful about the echo chamber too. You just don't want to be surrounded by 50,000 people who agree with you on everything. And that's the other thing too. Sometimes you think you have a feel for this, like I'll give you an example, the Chase, right? The the posting, I've always liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like eventually the fan base would come around, and they did, you know, with NASCAR fans, I think some did, but there's a certain group of readers whose opinions I value because I've got this sample size of 10 years of conversations with them. And if they all say so-and-so is not working, or I think this about this driver, and they all say it, then there's something to it,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
If it's just one guy speaking on his chest, I get 50 of those a day. You realize real quick not to listen to those guys. But yeah, so it's a very non-scientific way of taking the temperature of the sport.
Well, you kind of use the chatter, especially if it is, you know, not just coming from one egg avatar or one fake burner account, and kind of let that inform the content, that, especially when you're writing some of the longer form stuff for .com or for the magazine, or even stuff that you'll pitch to E60. Is it like, hey, I'm seeing a lot of in discussion about whatever, you know, this driver who's up and coming, or this topic in college baseball, or this topic here, or is it more, you know, the other way around, where it's, you know, I'm going to do what I think is the best story, and then, you know, strategically push it out the right way on those platforms to drive interest?
Yeah, so if I'm writing, I really do two different things when it comes to writing. Like, I do kind of big, long-form, like, features, and then I'll do columns.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do a column, you know, like, I've got a column coming out sometime in the next 24 hours. I wrote it yesterday about Kyle Busch.
Mm-hmm.
And about how, you know, I kind of compare him to LeBron James a little bit, which is, you know, at one time everyone hated him. But if you're really paying attention, what he's doing right now is incredible. And even if you don't care for him, and this goes for LeBron or Kyle Busch, you need to allow yourself a moment to appreciate, just appreciate what you're looking at, what you're watching. You know, mm-hmm. Same goes to Jimmy Johnson, though people don't seem to hate him like they used to. But just take a moment and put word about, is LeBron as good as Michael or better than Michael? Or is, you know, Jimmy Johnson better than Dale Earnhardt or Jeff Miller? That's fine. But we can debate that when they're done. You know, let's take a minute and appreciate it. And that was wholly based on interactions I was having with readers and fans over the last couple of months, but over the last over a year. So just, you know, there's been times when I didn't like Kyle Busch either. I've written columns about it. But I think there's a time where we should sit and appreciate, man, we're seeing something here, and we're going to wish we had paid better attention to it. So that's a good example of that. But if I'm writing a big feature, like if I'm going to Washington State and I'm writing a 3,000-word piece on Mike Leach, mm-hmm. I'm going to write what I'm going to write. You know, and then I'll see what the reaction's going to be. But I'm not going to let, with college football, it's a lot like the NASCAR fan base, but it's just so much bigger.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to let a bunch of mouthy Texas Tech fans or Craig James supporters, I'm not going to let them sway what I do or don't think about Mike Leach when I work on a story about it.
Do you think multi-platform now? Just a few more minutes left here with Ryan McGee, senior writer for ESPN Magazine, ESPN.com, and all over the place on ESPN. Do you, when you're, let's say you are out in Lubbock and talking to Cliff Kingsbury and you're working on a big story, are you now thinking, okay, how can I get an article about this? What kind of video, what kind of pull quote will I use for Twitter? You know, should this be an audio portion that we can use on a podcast? Like, have you almost become a multi-platform, you know, content producer as opposed to just a writer? Or how does that kind of come into play when you are, you know, when you get that access, when you get that time with, you know, with a Cliff Kingsbury, with a Mike Leach?
Yeah, so 100%. So, in fact, the Mike Leach thing is a great example. So, that was, you know, I can't remember who beat Washington State beat, but they were undefeated. They were like 5-6-0. They're knocking on the door of the top 10. They had Southern Cal coming in on Friday night on ESPN. And so kind of at the last minute, mm-hmm. my editor and I were like, you know what? It might be time to do the Mike Leach story. So I got on an early morning flight, you know, to Tacoma and flew across the country and went to his press conference and didn't really know if we were going to get much with him. And ended up spending 2 days with the guy. And on the first day, I had no TV camera, but I always take a tie and jacket with me just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And on Tuesday, he'd been so good on Monday. On Tuesday, SportsCenter sent a camera. And because I called, I said, listen, he's in a great mood. He's in great form right now.
Yeah.
And you know, and then once I put that on SportsCenter's radar, I call my editor at ESPN.com and I tell her, listen, I'm getting great stuff. And I recorded this interview with him last night, and the audio is pretty good on my phone. And I let radio know, hey, Mike Leach said so-and-so about USC. And, you know, we also, you write your story for ESPN.com, your feature, but you also have a responsibility if they say something that's newsworthy. You know, we have a news editor.
Yeah.
And we send them an email. Mike Leach just said, you know, so-and-so is an idiot. Or when I was there was right at the height of the NFL anthem protests had really taken a hold the Sunday I flew out there. And Mike Leach, who had supported Trump and had been very vocal about it on Sunday night when he talked to a reporter, you know, it was like, we have a news story here. You know, regardless of how you feel about the issue, if the coach of a top 10 team makes a very pointed comment about it, then I call the news desk and I go, hey, Mike Leach said so-and-so. And yeah. So, you know, I think we turned it into a little bitty news story that we ran during the week. So, yeah, your responsibility. I was talking to Gary Smith for Sports Illustrated, arguably the greatest magazine sports writer of all time. He's retired down in Charleston, South Carolina. I told Gary last year, I go, man, what was it like to work on 4 feature stories a year and not have to worry about all this other stuff? And because that'll never happen again.
Yeah.
And Wright Thompson, even the great Wright Thompson, who writes, you know, 4 or 5 big feature stories a year, writes my friend. But it's part of his responsibility too. If there's something that he thinks is TV worthy, is radio worthy, is news worthy, then you gotta let him know.
Yeah, you can't just sit on and hold it. That's for darn sure. And do you feel like you almost have to be a 5-tool player and be versatile? I mean, it's no secret that of course ESPN has thinned its team in the past few years, you know, and with cuts and layoffs here and there. And is the fact that you are multi-platform, that you can do audio, you can do radio hits, you can do reporting, you can do columns, you can do long form, is that really like, have you made it almost your job to make sure that you can master all these platforms so you can be as valuable as possible to the organization?
Yeah, sure, that's part of it. There's no question about it. But it's something I felt strongly about all along. And I think it's because I took this unconventional path of being a television producer who became a magazine writer.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm talking 20 years ago, you know, the magazine was in New York and, you know, everything else was in Connecticut. And I couldn't ever get, you know, the two ends on the phone. I couldn't get them on the phone together. And I would say, well, if I'm working on so-and-so, let's say I'm producing a TV feature for Off-Hand Tonight about Jeff Gordon, I think it'd be a good magazine piece. So yeah. I call the magazine. Well, the magazine wants exclusivity, or TV wants exclusivity. I'm like, no, that's not how it's going to work. And so, and then .com at that point was like 10 guys in a cubicle. And so I start going to them with stuff. And so, yeah, I think it just goes back to, you know, my weird way that I took. I was a cross-platform guy a really long time ago. And so when we would go, I'd go to a writer's conference, everybody sit there with their lip poked out. Well, I'm a magazine writer. I'm not a doc. I'm not an internet writer. I'm certainly not a TV reporter.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said earlier, a lot of my friends that I worked with 20 years ago who declared I'm a magazine writer, nothing else, they went in the tar pits a long time ago.
It's super insightful stuff. Ron, I got a bunch more I want to discuss with you, but before we get to Central Triple Stat, and then we'll have more fun with you in our pit stop segment, I would be remiss, I would not be doing my job here if I didn't ask about Hillbilly Headlines. It's probably it's just an awesome thing. If for listeners that don't know, on the podcast, now on Marty Smith's podcast as well, on the Marty McGee radio show, each week you guys pull out some of the best headlines, almost always from Florida, that have some great hillbilly activity going on. So just, if you can, briefly tell me about the origin of Hillbilly Headlines and how it came about.
I think it started with you know, so Marty and McGee, we started doing a podcast 4 or 5 years ago that no one listened to. And then eventually the right person got promoted to the right job and they put us on the radio for a little bit. And, you know, I think the origin was we just started telling stories about stuff we had seen at the racetrack. And then that led to us telling stories about, you know, rednecks doing stupid stuff and being arrested. And then people started sending us stories. Like, we started getting, like, you know, on social media, somebody would hear a podcast and they said it. So we put a title on it, Hillbilly Headlines. We went through a couple different titles, but Hillbilly Headlines is what we settled on. And now, you know, we do a 2-hour radio show, and I swear I think people are just, the first hour and 45 minutes is just garnish. They're just, you know, it's just that they're just trying to get to the Hillbilly Headlines. We did the show in front of a live audience for the first time at the Indy 500. And granted, it was about 20 people, but they were just sitting there waiting on us to shut up and get to the Hillbilly Headlines. Like, when we got to the Hillbilly Headlines at 7 o'clock, everybody sat up in their seat. So, yeah, it's, and now we have correspondents. You know, we have a reporter down in Florida, and we kept going back. We kept using the audio from her TV reports. And now we have her on the show to report Florida, which is their single greatest export. The state of Florida is not ours. The Hillbilly Headline. And then we have a reporter in North Carolina, my buddy Dave Wisnett, same thing. He just, after you kept reporting, you know, stories of people setting themselves on fire and, you know, stealing Walmart scooters and trying to outrun police and, you know, naked people. The amount of naked people just blows my mind. How people just get naked and just run around. And it's, there's no shortage I think there's been an increase in stupid redneck activity just since we started doing this, because you just have to look for stories. And now, you know, we have to weed them out.
Oh, so great. And I feel like there's a merchandise opportunity there. Like, I'd buy a shirt that you know, references the Sketty line or naked versus naked, all that good stuff.
Yeah, so the great Louis Grizzard, who was my hero, wrote for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's the one that had the line. He said, you know, if you don't have any clothes on, you're naked. If you don't have any clothes on and you're up to something, you're naked. And these people in the Hillbilly Headlines are 100% naked.
Oh, so much fun. Ryan, so much more I want to talk to you about, but we'll get to some quick-hitting questions in our Pit Stop segment coming up next. But first, episode of Shareable Stat coming at you now.
Fun stuff with Ryan McGee of ESPN, ESPN the Magazine, ESPN.com. Really enjoy talking to him. I could really pick his brain and talk to him for hours, and I feel like I do all the time because I still listen to him all the time on the radio and on podcasts. But we'll have a little more fun with Ryan coming in our Pit Stop segment. Definitely want to stick around for that. But first, this episode's a Shareable Stat. This episode's Shareable Stat reinforces something that we've known all along for a long time, and that's all about the second screen. Especially heading into the World Cup this year, we've seen a lot of different articles and studies about how advertisers, how brands, how the World Cup, how the teams are leveraging the second screen. And this study that I found said that 80% of fans surveyed, 80% of fans who watch sports said that they will use a mobile device to look up stats or player info or watch highlights while they're watching the game on the big TV, on linear TV or the big screen, wherever it may be. That is a pretty powerful fact, a pretty powerful stat. 80%, which means 4 out of every 5 fans watching a game on TV, watching a live game on television, will use their mobile device to reference or look up something about the game. So what does that mean if you're a team or organization in sports? It means you know that your fans are using that second screen. So whether it's about entertaining them or really anticipating their needs, the fact that that survey looked at fans who were looking up something, you know, looking, wanting to see that replay, wanting to see more about who that player is that did X, Y, or Z, or who that pitcher is that came in, or who that guy is that made that catch or made that shot. So what can you do? Anticipate what they're looking for. Prepare stuff in advance, you know, in easily consumable formats or even engaging formats, or that means graphics for each player or little infographics or little mini videos that have more information, and certainly replays if they're available to you within the rights. So think about what your fans are doing with the second screen. A lot of times we're looking to chase those quote-unquote vanity metrics, the retweets, having those GIFs, those pre-prepared GIFs that you spent all offseason creating for every moment in the game. But also think about the information, the utility that you can give to your fans. They're sitting around watching the game on live TV. Maybe they're at a sports bar. Maybe they're at home and with their friends or family. You know, what can you give them that will help enhance their viewing experience? You know, give them a little factoid they can tell their friends or family members about one of the players that just did something big in the game. Overall, just think about what that utility is, what that it is that fans were looking up at that given time or using their mobile device for at that given time. Obviously, it's a lot of communication as well, a lot of quote-unquote dark social, but the more value you can provide, the better you'll be to stimulate that second screen and be a welcomed presence on any social platform for fans watching the game. So that's a social shareable stat. 80% of fans that are watching a game on live TV will use a mobile device to look up player info or highlights during the game. All right, that's the social shareable stat. We'll be right back for some pit stops with Ryan McGee of ESPN.com, ESPN the magazine.
Back from this episode's shareable stat and joined once again by Ryan McGee, senior writer for ESPN the magazine, ESPN.com, ESPN overall. Ryan had a great interview with you. Are you now ready to do a few pit stops?
Yeah, man.
Let's do it. All right. I want to know, number one, your favorite NASCAR personality you've worked with all time, and also the best NASCAR driver currently on social media.
Dale Jr., I know he's not in the car anymore, but what he does on social media is unbelievable. I think he's the biggest star in the sport still. I told him the other day, he's got a bigger presence in social media now than he did when he was driving.
Yeah.
And so and when Clint Boyer decides to do it, which isn't very often, but when Clint Boyer decides to do it, he's talking about some redneck ingenuity. He's unbelievable. and as far as the greatest personality ever, I've been so fortunate to work with so many. I mean, Steve Burns, I miss him every day. He was one of my dearest friends. But it's hard to top Benny Parson. And working with BP back in the day, and BP, we'd be Daytona, and we'd be about to walk out of the office to go out into the garage, and he'd say, it's time to go see the hay, Benny. I go, what? And we'd walk out in the garage, and everybody'd be like, hey, Benny, all day.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. I love that. Number two for you. This is going to be a tough one. It's like picking children, perhaps. But tell me your favorite story you've ever written, or stories, if it's too hard to choose just one.
Say that again, man. I'm sorry you're breaking up.
Yeah, no, your favorite story or stories that you've ever written.
I'll give you one that nobody ever remembers, but I wrote a story with Usain Bolt, the sprinter. Mm-hmm. And this was at the dawn of social media, and I went down to Jamaica, and I was kind of addicted to Facebook at that point, and I vanished from Facebook for 3 days because I had no cell service, and there was an NASCAR crew guy named Ryan McGee who OD'd and went face down in the lake. Well, New Hampshire Motor Speedway, the word gets out, and Ryan McGee is dead in the lake and OD'd. And everybody assumes it's me.
Oh, jeez.
And my wife turns on the television on Sunday morning, and the local TV affiliate in North Carolina, Charlotte, is reporting that I'm dead.
Oh, my.
And so, and no one can reach me, because I'm up on a mountain with Usain Bolt down in Jamaica. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I land that night in Charlotte, and my phone is just going crazy. And I call a buddy of mine at New Hampshire, and he runs into the media center and goes, oh, my God, he's alive. So that's my Paul McCartney being dead moment.
Oh wow, that's a hell of a tale, man. That's a great story to whip out of parties for sure.
Yeah, and Bolt was awesome, and it was one of my favorite stories to do. And I went down there, and I didn't think I was going to get anything, and ended up spending a week with the guy. He was unbelievable.
Yeah, being able to spend time with the GOAT in his sport for sure. Number three for you. You think this is whatever direction you'd like. If you were running NASCAR media today. Or just in NASCAR overall, what is the first thing you do to help the sport grow? What do you think they need to do down there?
Well, I think that it's having a little fun, man. You know, why is the Darlington Throwback such a hit? Because it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think the big thing is just finding a way to get everybody to focus on the race. You know, I turn on the radio or get on Twitter or whatever, and Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday, you know, Kevin Harvick's won his third or fourth race in a row. And everybody's talking about illegal rear windows and one driver pouting on Twitter. I just, we talk about everything except for the actual race, and I just don't run into that in any other sport.
No, that's a really good insight, actually. You see, they're spending so much time trying to get every last casual fan, casual viewer they can. They tend to forget what's happening actually on the racetrack sometimes. Super interesting.
It's crazy.
Number four for you. I know you made an acting. You had a little acting experience, kinda in Talladega Nights, part of the filming there. So, just give me your best anecdote or story from being part of that shoot.
So when there's a scene in the movie where Jamie McMurray is racing with Ricky Bobby, and Ricky Bobby beats him driving backwards, and they actually shot that on a little sound stage in front of a green screen in downtown Charlotte. And not a lot of drivers are in that movie because people were worried about how the sport was going to be portrayed. They're a little oversensitive. Mm-hmm. But Jamie McMurray and Will Ferrell sitting in these roll cages on the floor in this film studio, and Jamie didn't understand that the way Will Ferrell shoots a movie is they just roll the camera and he just ad-libs. And him just wearing Jamie McMurray out and kept flipping him off. And McMurray, at first, Jamie was a really nice guy. At first, he didn't understand. Like, he thought, what are we doing here? Because this wasn't in the script. And then he kind of got his feelings hurt because he kept getting flipped off. And then Will Ferrell said to him, dude, we're just messing around. And once McMurray got into it, Jamie has that great line in the movie with his ad-lib. Of course, with that high-pitched voice, he goes, see you, I'd want to be here.
Oh, that's great. I think personally overall that movie was good for the sport, and it drove interest, awareness, and it's one of the more memorable movie characters of all time, really. That's a great one.
We call it NASCAR Media Group making mistakes. Pixar comes to NASCAR, and NASCAR's office in Hollywood told Pixar to take a hike, and so they turned down Cars.
Wow.
Like, the Pixar people made all the NASCAR, they went to Humpy Wheeler because NASCAR will play ball with them. And the reason was because they were doing the movie with Will Ferrell and they were doing Herbie.
Ah, wow, that's interesting, right? For sure. That's a hell of a story. Wow. That's inside baseball there for you. All right, number five for you, Ryan. I want to know whether it was as a fan or for work, what is or was the most memorable sports event game you've ever attended?
I always go back to the, when Earnhardt went into 500 Daytona 500. That's hard to top racing-wise. But I tell you this, 2011 was the centennial Indianapolis 500. It wasn't the 100th race, but it was the centennial race.
Mm-hmm.
And that day, all the really old guys, Parnelli Jones and AJ, they were all still young enough to get around. And those guys spent the morning driving the original race cars from the teens and the 20s and the 30s around the racetrack. That was Jim Neighbors' last back home in Indiana. And then the end of that race was J.R. Hildebrand hit the wall and Dan Weldon win it. And so from the crack of dawn until time to shut it down that night, I never had a better day at the racetrack than the 2011 Indy 500.
That's so cool. Really just every single element from the old guys to the race itself. That's awesome, man.
That's perfect.
All right, number six for you. We talked about the origin of hillbilly headlines. Now I want to know your favorite hillbilly headline of all time.
That would be the two guys who broke into a trailer, and while both of them were ex-boyfriends of the man who was asleep in the trailer, they broke into the trailer and they tried to burn it down with him in it. And the way they decided they were going to do that was to make it look like an accident. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, they tried to cook spaghetti on the stove and threw a bunch of rags on it, thinking that it would start a fire and burn the trailer down. So two jilted lovers trying to burn down their boyfriend's trailer with cooking spaghetti at 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's exactly, when they interviewed the guy that they tried to burn his place down, he goes, well, who tries to cook spaghetti at 3 o'clock in the morning? That's the greatest hillbilly headline of all time.
Oh, you'll get no disagreement there. If anyone's listening that has not heard that audio, look it up. That belongs in the Smithsonian or something. That's fantastic. All right, number seven for you, Ryan. I know you've spent a lot of time with college baseball. I've written a book as well, and still covering it to this day. So tell me the most memorable experience you've had in Omaha, you know, whether it's part of the book or not?
It's the greatest. And I love the new ballpark. It's great. The bathrooms work. The elevators works. But the old ballpark, the bathrooms, nor the elevator works. But I love the old Rosenblatt Stadium. But for me, it was after the last game, College World Series game played in that stadium, and get to stand out on the field, and they brought out a guy, a bugler, who played Take Me Out to the Ball Game, but he played it real slow like it was taps.
Yeah.
And they turned the lights off in the ballpark, and it was right after South Carolina had scored in a walk-off run, and I grabbed a scoop of dirt off the third baseline, and I still have it on my desk. So it was hard to beat Rosenblatt Stadium, man, and it was now it's a parking lot. But as you get older, a lot of the cool places in your life turn into parking lots. That's what you learn.
that's a cool anecdote, though, and I can get goosebumps just sort of picturing that scene as you laid it out there. That's really cool. All right, Ryan, come number eight here, coming to the finish line almost. Tell me, if I'm down in North Carolina, I know there's a lot of good food down south, so if I go to visit you down in Charlotte or just in the Carolinas overall, what's the best food? Where do I got to go to get the best food down there?
Lexington, North Carolina, and I'm not making this up. I'm on the phone with you driving down the road, and I'm about to pull into a place called Lexington Barbecue in Lexington, North Carolina, and this is an acquired taste. This is vinegar-based smoked pork barbecue in the Piedmont of North Carolina, but it is the best. It's what I was raised on, and you hear of Lexington-style barbecue. If you ever want to have a nice afternoon, go to Richard Childress Racing in Welcome, which is one town over from Lexington. Go see all of Dale Earnhardt's awesome race cars, and then go get you some Lexington barbecue.
That sounds like a nice afternoon to me, man. You're making me hungry and wanting to see that for sure. All right, number nine for you, Ryan. Tell me, besides your radio partner, Marty Smith, who does an incredible job, tell me your favorite personality at ESPN.
That's a great question, because I've been there so long that I know so many people, and you know, good and bad. But you cannot top the general, Bob Lee.
Yeah.
Bob Lee finally this year won the Sports Emmy for Best Anchor. And why in the world he's just winning this thing now, I don't know. But, you know, at ESPN we have what we call the 79ers. Mm-hmm. And they're the people who have been with the company since it first started in 1979. And Bob is one of those guys. When he walks in the room, I mean, he's Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings, when he walks in the room, there's a level of respect that you feel no matter what network, we're all competitive, but no matter what network you work for, and Bob Lee, when the general walks into the room, and here's the thing too, he's hilarious. He is a super funny person. And I'm glad that now with E60 and Outside the Lines, they're letting him, show a little bit of funny Bob, because not a lot of people realize that exists.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, there's a Mount Rushmore for ESPN, folks. He's definitely on it. There's no doubt about that. Number 10 for Ryan, last question here. Which NASCAR driver will be the number one name in the sport in 10 years? That's a tough one.
It is a tough one. I keep waiting on the Ryan Blaney train to get going because I think she has all the tools. I want for Chase Elliott to show the personality that I know that he has, but I don't know that he ever is. But he has a chance to be the guy at some point. But I think Blaney's the guy. I think that I'll give you my example on Blaney. I have a 13-year-old daughter who could care less about any of this.
Mm-hmm.
But last year when Blaney won, was it at Pocono? And he's doing his victory lane speech, and all of a sudden my daughter looked up from her phone and went, "Who is that?" And what that tells me is that he has a lot of crossover potential. So if they let him be the guy that he can really be, and he wins races like I know that he can, that guy is a millennial and is young, and he'll certainly, by the time we hit 10 years from now, he might have been a champion a couple times over.
Yeah, we'll definitely watch out for Ryan Blaney, and there's a lot of good young guys on the circuit now. So hopefully, they'll continue to grow with the sport here over the next decade, and then some. All right, Ryan, we nailed the pit stops and your chance to take over the podcast here and tell us your social media all-star to follow? Typically someone on Twitter, who they are and why we should follow them.
Yeah, I'm ESPN McGee, and my Instagram account is like super secret. So that's the ESPN McGee too. You can go over there too. And but hey, listen, I appreciate Twitter. Even the days I hate it, it's still not bad. And hey, that's how we met.
Heck yeah, man! It's got plenty of its downsides, I guess, but the positives always outweigh the negatives for me.
Right about the time I lose faith in Twitter, I'll put something on Twitter about barbecue or about, you know, a redneck car saw on the road or, you know, Dukes of Hazzard or something, and the response I get back, it makes me feel better about the world again.
There you go. At the end of the day, it's great for conversation. It's cool to know that there's someone out there listening on the other side, and they have shared interests with you. They're willing to talk to you. They're willing to tell you how much they love your work or hate your work. And it's a whole other era, and you've managed to thrive before and after. So my appreciation to you and my admiration for you, and I really can't thank you enough for coming on today in the middle of the baseball season for college, and of course the NASCAR season never stops, and it's been great picking your brain today a little bit, Ryan.
All right, brother. Hey, Tom.
Thank you so much again to Ryan McGee of ESPN. Just a really genuinely good guy. Will give time to anyone and just does a great job in his field. Someone I cannot read enough of, and seriously, not even saying that. The check's not in the mail in that case, but really appreciate Ryan giving us some of his time during a very busy time of the year for him. He's, you know, about to finish a book, is covering the College World Series, and of course the redneck beat goes on with hillbilly headlines and motorsports every single day, every single week. But that'll do this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for joining us. You can get other episodes at dsmsports.net and Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, all those good places. And you can follow me, your host, on Twitter at NJH287. And, of course, hit me up, Neil Horwitz, on LinkedIn for other content as well. Until next time, this is Neil Horwitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.